A generation ago, those expenses took up about half of a single-income family's pay. Today, the figure is more like 75%. With 75% of income earmarked for fixed expenses, today's family has no margin for error. There is no way to cut back if one person's working hours are cut, or if the other gets laid off. There is no room in the budget if someone needs to take a few months off to care for grandma, or if someone hurts his back and can't work. The modern American family is walking on a high wire without a net. They pray there won't be any wind. If all goes well, they will make it across safely. Their children will grow up and finish college, and they will move on to retirement. But if anything, anything at all, goes wrong, they are in big, big trouble. And where are many of us? In big, big trouble. For many of us, the trouble begins early, when we're just starting out in life. That is also the time, however, when making some smart moves and building the right habits can set us up for a stable financial life, maybe even a prosperous one. That's what this chapter is about. And our own experiences help show how certain decisions, bad and good, can shape your financial future. Here's your preview. There's only one real piece of advice in this chapter, and that is to start saving early. The corollary to that piece of advice is to develop a simple investment strategy that focuses on long-term gains with low costs. But we'll get into that later. First, I'll give you a little of our own financial history. How we started out. To understand how Gene and I got into the financial troubles that dogged us for so much of our adult lives, it helps to know our early days together. We met on a boiling August day in Austin, Texas. It was 1975, and classes at the University of Texas would begin in a week. We had both chosen UT largely because it was a great school in a wonderful town, and neither of us flattered ourselves with the pretension that we were Ivy League material. Besides, it was cheap as rocks, and many of our friends were also going there. We had found our way into a liberal arts honors program that suited our desire to read important books and learn big things. Most important, we met each other. We were eerily well-matched, fast-talking, word-crazed, and excited about everything around us. She had red hair and freckles, and in the hot months, didn't bother putting on a lot of clothes. I'm not sure what she saw in me, but more than 40 years later, I remain grateful. Within a few weeks, we were dating. By the end of the semester, we were living together. My roommate in those cramped quarters, who was a saint, tolerated the arrangement. Hi, Vincent. My folks, who were also saints, put several hundred dollars in my bank account each month to cover rent, gas, and our forays to second-hand bookstores, something they might not have been able to do if I'd attended a fancy school in the Northeast. And we did well. I got a variety of jobs. Dorm resident assistant, library clerk, projectionist for Cinema Texas, the campus organization that filled the auditoriums each weekend with fans of horror movies and other fare. I even had a brief career as a deliverer of singing telegrams. Gene worked at, among other places, Mad Dog and Beans, a burger place just west of campus where the day's best employee got to take a rack of emptied whipped cream canisters and suck in the last whiffs of nitrous oxide for a brief buzz. Life was, in other words, splendid. Back in the 1970s, Austin was a place where we could live on love and sofa change. I mean this literally. When we were broke, Gene and I dug around behind the sofa cushions and found enough quarters, dimes, and pennies to buy an avocado. Los Tacos, a dumpy little place down the street from Mad Dog's, had a 50-cent bean and rice burrito that was nearly as big as my head. My parents had also handed me a single, very specialized credit card. It worked only at the Nighthawk, a local chain of steakhouses with a location on the drag next to campus. So when we were too broke for even a scrounged change avocado or a trip to Los Tacos, we could get a steak and a loaded baked potato. The town, still pretty sleepy back then, nonetheless had a burgeoning live music scene with everything from cosmic cowboy to punk. It was a place full of opportunities for finding things to do what we could do for free. As the singer Robert Earl Keen put it in his perfect song about slackerdom, dreadful selfish crime. And tuition? That's the cheap as rocks part. Thanks to oil riches under the lands that the University of Texas owned, tuition in those days was ludicrously low. Each semester cost less than $200. I was able to graduate without college debt. We had very little. We have never felt richer. Even so, those Austin days were filled with lessons about money. The world around us seemed to be saying one word over and over. Spend, spend, spend. The first automated teller machines made their appearance in the United States several years before we got to college. By the mid-1970s, when we were undergraduates, our local Austin National Bank had them. The change was monumental. The bank didn't need to be open for you to make a withdrawal. No standing in line. No fretting about whether you could get a check cashed late at night before heading out to hear some music. The brand name on the teller machines was appealing and apt. Anytime. Gene saw the downside risk of the robot tellers right away. Whenever we stopped by one of the machines, she'd say in a cheery announcer voice, "Now you can go broke. Anytime." We had little income, but already, come-ons from credit card companies were arriving in the mail. The form letters were seductive. Start building your credit record now, with us. What they didn't say was, you can ruin your credit record now, with us, before you even really get started in life. We avoided disaster by not getting a card until we were both employed full-time. The risk was there from the start. But how bad could it be? Even if we built up a balance on the card, the minimum charge was easy enough to pay. We had found our first slippery slope. Back then, some of the people around us were, in their own laid-back Austin way, starting to think about their financial future. My friend Will Van Overbeek, a brilliant photographer, had already become successful enough with freelance work that he was able to buy a small gem of a house north of campus. A friend at Mad Dogs solemnly told Gene, "I'm trying to get my money trip together," though it was unclear what he meant by that. Another friend, Clay, always seemed to have plenty of money. He dated a roommate of ours and took her out to the best restaurants in town, places where we couldn't have afforded the appetizers. They went on romantic sailboat rides. It didn't take long to figure out where the cash came from. Clay sold cocaine. We got a glimpse of what a lot of money could get you at our age, and also a good lesson in risk and reward. One day, Clay turned up dead, beaten to death, with what the police report referred to as a blunt object. His business associates, we later heard, decided he had snitched. We graduated from college with our liberal arts degrees. It was time to start thinking about how I would make my money, preferably with less risk than Clay had made his. So I prepared for a career. I got into UT's law school, largely for lack of a plan. My father and two of my brothers are lawyers, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. Law school tuition was also less than $200 per semester. My textbooks cost more. I had a decent first year, making unspectacular grades, but keeping up with my fellow students, learning how to read judicial opinions, and sparring with the professors over points of law. But life intervened. In my second year at the school, I began writing for the university's magazine and its award-winning newspaper, the Daily Texan. It wasn't my first foray into journalism. The bug bit me early. In sixth grade, I created and ran a paper for Mrs. Hensley's class, typing the Hensley Herald up on mimeograph paper on an enormous IBM executive typewriter my folks kept in the front room. The typewriter hummed. It radiated heat and smelled like machine oil. I fell in love with that beast. I kept writing, helping start a newspaper in high school as well. So it was natural for me to gravitate toward journalism in college, and it made for a nice sideline to my legal training. But during my second year of law school, and the first year I was working at the Texan, the staff walked out on the editor, throwing the publication into crisis. The board that governed the paper put me in charge for the rest of the school year. That watershed moment set up a bifurcated life. My days were spent at the law school and my evenings at the Texan. It didn't take me long to figure out which part of the day felt more natural to me, to know where I fit in best. The student journalists were just as smart as the future lawyers, and equally ambitious. But they didn't take themselves as seriously, and their parties were way more fun. I had more in common with the wisecracking kids putting the paper together in the basement of the communications building than with the serious young legal eagles up 26th Street. The law students also seemed much more interested in practicing law than I was. I hadn't been deluding myself about my skills or interests. I saw in myself no emerging knack for the law. Yet I figured that while I wasn't likely to have a blazing career as a rich partner in a big firm, I could still end up comfortably doing divorces or personal injury cases and running loud ads that hawked my services on late-night television. That probably would have been enough. I could hold a cigar, wear a cowboy hat, yell at the camera. That's how other lawyers on late-night TV commercials did it, and they looked successful. But after I finished my year as Texan editor, I started doing a fair amount of freelance writing. Most of the pieces brought in very little money. After finishing my first story for the Texas Observer, the legendary progressive journal of free voices based in Austin, the editor told me he couldn't pay me, but urged me to just go out in the hall and grab a couple of books off of the shelf. Other publications, though, were starting to pay me a dollar a word, or more. Things began looking up. I saw another way to make a living outside of lawyering. When law school was done, I was still undecided about my future. It was 1984. The nation was climbing out of a recession, and either career looked pretty good. People got out of college and, for the most part, got jobs. With no debt hanging over my head, I was inclined to follow my dreams, as all commencement speakers advise us to do, and try to be a journalist. My folks were not convinced. They had been thrilled when I had gotten into law school, especially since it was the same law school that Dad had graduated from. He knew plenty of reporters, having served for 2 decades in the state legislature and become a senior member of the Texas Senate. Reporters loved him. He is preternaturally quotable, but he didn't think much of journalists. My folks saw a stable and bright future for me in the law, and the prospect of my throwing in with the ink-stained kvetchers was not a happy one. On one visit back to our home in Galveston, Dad handed me a book he'd picked up. The title was, "You Can Make $20,000 a Year Writing." My, how he laughed. By then, Gene and I had gotten married, so now we were partners in big decisions. It was time to make one. I asked her what she thought. Would it be all right with her if I tried journalism as a career? If, at the end of 5 years, I've got a real job with a dental plan, I'll stick with it, I told her. If not, I'll be a lawyer and do divorces. What do you think? She didn't take long to answer. She wanted an adventure and also wanted to get out of Austin and live someplace like New York City. She took the deal. I'd also gotten a gentle shove from my boss at the time, an editor at Texas Monthly. "Johnny, you know your world very well," he said. "But it starts at the river and ends at 29th Street," which described the area from downtown Austin to the north border of the campus. He suggested that I expand my horizons. Both Gene and I had come from comfortable families, but not from wealth. We joked that each of us thought the other was rich. "Your dad was a state senator," she'd say. I'd reply, "Your granddad was an oil man." "An oil service man," she'd explain. He didn't strike it rich on gushers, He poured the concrete for drilling platforms that made the drillers rich. Or poor. You never knew. Anyway, neither of us had, as the characters in the old British novel put it, married money. But we were fundamentally Texan, which means believing in self-reliance and being willing to work hard and take risks, and in being guided by a kind of optimism that everything will work out if you work at it. So we held hands and took a leap. Getting a job in journalism, though, was not easy. I applied to a number of publications in New York without immediate success. I didn't have the experience at local newspapers or the journalism prizes that big city publications like to see. I did have a possible in, though, at Newsweek, a magazine I'd been freelancing for since I'd ended my term as Texan editor. In my trips to New York to meet with Newsweek editors, I would always see Jerry, the guy who headed Newsweek on campus, which was the college edition of the magazine. I'd been doing most of my stringing for him. He bemoaned a hiring freeze imposed on the magazine by upper management and assured me, if the freeze were ever lifted, you're high on my list. This sounded promising. What I did not understand about fancy New York editors is that lines like, you're high on my list, are sweet nothings that provide hope without substance, intended to get you out of their offices and on your way in time for them to have a nice long lunch and then come back to get through the rest of the day's work. After a nap on their very comfortable couches, because lunches in those days tended to include adult beverages. That high on my list thing was a way to keep me available, but at bay. In the years since that Newsweek job, I would meet more than one resentful journalist who told me that the same editor had told him that he was high on his list, and who felt I had taken the job that had been promised to him. How long was Jerry's list anyway? I'd see other Newsweek editors during those trips. One tilted back in his chair with his feet up on the desk, told me that he'd like to hire me, but that the magazine was in the middle of, yes, again, a hiring freeze. I blurted out that I could wait a long time in Austin, since my share of the rent on the big house Jean and I shared with some buddies was just $150 a month. His eyes narrowed. He growled, I despise you. I waited. A year later, I had the job. It happened through a combination of dumb luck and perseverance. After finishing law school and passing the bar exam, why not? I called the editor whose list I was so proudly on. Jerry, I said, since I'm high on your list, why don't you just hire me? My wife and I have decided to move to New York. I'll be there the last week in April, so you won't have to pay any relocation expenses. Then an amazing thing happened. He told me to show up for work the first week in May. What I did not know was that one of his small cadre of writers had just left Newsweek on campus, and he had a hole to fill. He was a lawyer, too, and liked the fact that I'd taken the bar. It shows you finish what you start, he told me. What about that hiring freeze? Still there, but he'd figured a clever workaround. He would pay me a full-time salary out of his freelance budget. He said he could offer me $26,000 a year. Those 1985 dollars would be close to $60,000 today. He named the sum, and I did some quick mental math to find that this would cover the rent I expected to pay and other living expenses. In fact, it sounded like wealth. I said yes, without a moment of negotiation. I came up and slept on a friend's floor for several weeks, while starting work and finding an apartment for Jean and me. Every evening after work, I'd walk from Midtown to the Upper West Side to get to know my new city. Along the Central Park Reservoir, I bumped into a friend from Texas. This actually happens in New York. It has something to do with the population density. We chattered a bit. He'd been living here for a few years, he said, and was working at Solomon Brothers. He had one piece of advice that he delivered with a chilling edge. New York is great, he said. Don't run out of money. Thanks to another Newsweek boss, Lynn Povich, I snagged a one-year sublet on an apartment on the Upper West Side for $1,000 a month. Jean got to town a few weeks later, and we were on our way. My mental math that said we'd be rolling in money turned out to be faulty. New York was expensive. But by the time I realized that, it didn't matter. I was launched. And if we were going to be squeezed, well, there are a lot of sofa cushions and avocados in the world. Finding things to do that you can do for free in New York wasn't that difficult. And the free things were grand. Watching Shakespeare in the park, sneaking onto the roof of our building to watch the 4th of July fireworks, and using my Newsweek ID to get complimentary access to great museums. Just walking around the city is a free show daily. We ate inexpensive burgers. You could still find them in New York then. And watched movies for next to nothing at the Thalia, an art house whose aisles, weirdly, sloped upward toward the screen. One day we sat in the dark and watched a Roger Corman horror triple feature. Jean got her master's degree in history from NYU and worked as a secretary, and later in the archives of Trinity Church and the New York Public Library Theater Collection. Life was damn good. My job was hard. My job was fun. I did the job. At the end of that year, one of the top editors of Newsweek called me into his office. He wanted me to know that they had defrosted the hiring freeze slightly, or at least enough to actually hire me. It didn't hurt that the union that represented Newsweek's rank and file had started making noises that hiring somebody out of a freelance budget and not paying benefits looked like a violation of the union contract. If they had filed a grievance, or, to use the labor jargon, grieved me, I'd probably have lost the job. Instead, I was finally really hired. At the end of our conversation, the editor, a natty gentleman who wore hand-tailored shirts with those fancy white collars, told me that my new salary would be substantially more than what I had been earning. He explained dryly, "We don't have anyone writing here who makes what you've been making." He was letting me know, without saying it out loud, that I'd been played for a rube by the guy who had hired me. Was I mad? Nah. Jerry had gotten me in the door, and the editor who had just finished telling me what a dope I'd been softened the blow by telling me that writers at the magazine made at least $40,000 a year, and so that would be my new salary. He had just raised my pay by 50%. In 2017 dollars, the new salary came to more than $88,000 a year. It still wasn't enough to live high in such an expensive city, but it was a great bump and a great start. Even being brought into Newsweek at a bargain salary was, in a strange way, a favor. It meant Jean and I had to learn to stretch our paychecks. And for the time being, it was enough. Enough. The word is resonant. John C. Bogle, the personal investing trailblazer and author, loves to tell the story of the writers Kurt Vonnegut and Joseph Heller at a billionaire's party out on Shelter Island, New York. Vonnegut told Heller that their host made more in a single day than Heller made off every copy of Catch-22 ever sold. Heller responded, "Yes, but I have something he'll never have. Enough." Bogle used that story for the title and introduction of his 2008 book, Enough, True Measures of Money, Business, and Life. And it's profound. What is enough? Enough to live on? Enough to retire on? Which gets us back to our little family and our story. So, there we were. I had gotten a job at an internationally recognized magazine. As the giveaway pencil said in engraved letters, Newsweek was America's most quoted news weekly. And I had a decent salary, higher than the $20,000 a year promised by the book Dad had handed me as a joke. Enough. Was it enough? Well, is any amount enough? When you hear money can't buy happiness, do you get irked? I always want to respond, well, let me test that hypothesis. No less an authority on the perils of wealth than the late rapper known as the Notorious B.I.G., put it simply, "More money, more problems." Again, while I respect your expertise, sir, let me find out for myself. I will try out the aforesaid Mo Money, and I'll judge the scale and scope of the resultant problems. There has actually been some well-regarded research into the amount of money it takes to make people happy, and whether there is a point of diminishing returns. The psychologist Daniel Kahneman and the economist Angus Deaton of Princeton University published a famous paper in 2010 showing that while people's level of happiness does rise with the amount of money they have, that correlation ends after income rises beyond $75,000. Both professors Kahneman and Deaton, who are winners of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science, analyzed nearly 500,000 responses to Gallup polling on well-being. What they found about poverty was obvious. The pain of misfortunes like divorce or being alone is significantly greater for people making less than $1,000 a month. The authors stated, "More money does not necessarily buy more happiness, but less money is associated with emotional pain." In trying to decide why things did not get significantly better for people who made more than $75,000, they wrote, "Perhaps $75,000 is a threshold beyond which further increases in income no longer improve individuals' ability to do what matters most to their emotional well-being, such as spending time with people they like, avoiding pain and disease, and enjoying leisure." Of course, most people still believe that more money will mean more happiness. It's just that it doesn't always turn out that way. The researchers Elizabeth W. Dunn and Michael Norton, she is an associate professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, and he is an associate professor of business at Harvard Business School, found that American surveyed predicted that someone making $55,000 would find twice the satisfaction in life of someone making just $25,000. When the researchers actually compared the satisfaction levels of people making $55,000 and those making $25,000, however, they found a jump of just 9%. I got the job at Newsweek before any of this amazing research had gotten out there. All we knew was that we had a lot more money than we'd had when Gene was making milkshakes and I was delivering singing telegrams. But in light of Kahneman's work, it turned out that with my first job out of college, we were, in inflation-adjusted dollars, beating the happiness line, at least initially. True, we were living in a very expensive city, and that makes a difference. In many parts of Texas, $40,000 could have made me feel rich, but not in New York City. Yet Kahneman has said that the $75,000 threshold is the same in expensive cities as in inexpensive ones. While some of my colleagues were struggling financially and came from working-class roots, a surprising number, it seemed to me, were swimming in cash. Jean and I were still looking for things that we could do for free, but they weekended in the Hamptons, or on Shelter Island, or up at the family's summer house. "It's really pretty basic," they'd say almost dismissively, "and not much to look at." One editor spent an evening dinner telling the rest of us about how damned expensive it was to properly maintain the large pond on his property. Many of my co-workers had degrees from Ivy League colleges, and I learned from them the snippy things that Ivy grads said about other Ivy grads. They loved to make fun of those Harvard people. A Brown grad joked, "Question, how can you tell if someone went to Harvard? Answer, they'll tell you." These were not jokes I heard in Austin. For a land-grant university boy, it was eye-opening. These were people who never had to dig in their sofa cushions to be able to pay for an avocado. Some had substantial double incomes, thanks to a spouse who was a doctor or lawyer, or Wall Street shark. Whatever their income level, I found my colleagues smart, talented, and fun to be around. I wasn't like Josiah Crawley, the impoverished reverend in Anthony Trollope's Framley Parsonage, who rejected the fellowship of his well-off college classmate. His poverty had been so terrible to himself that it was not in his heart to love a rich friend. I didn't resent their vacations, though I could have stood to hear a bit less about them. That first step. That pay bump at Newsweek allowed me to make a decision that affected every other financial decision we'd ever make. As a real employee, I'd be eligible to enroll in a retirement savings plan, a 401k. Newsweek also offered a pension plan, which I'd be enrolled in automatically. But my friends told me that I'd be nuts to pass up the 401k. The pension would not pay for much of a retirement, they explained. And the Washington Post company, which owned Newsweek, sweetened the savings by kicking in extra money to match a portion of what you contributed. So I signed up, picking some Vanguard mutual funds from Newsweek's offerings that looked good to me. One was the popular Vanguard Wellington Fund, which has been around since the 1920s and which offers a diversified mix of stocks and bonds. I had no sophisticated method of choosing the fund, no theory of investing. I assigned 10% of my income to the account, money I'd probably never miss, because it was money I hadn't been getting before. Jumping from $26,000 a year to $40,000 a year let me make the move without feeling a pinch. And then I basically forgot about it. This is important. Even when we got squeezed financially as time went by, we never considered dropping the weekly contribution to the 401k. We were able to treat it as one more of those mysterious, untouchable lines on the pay stub, down in there with the Social Security withholding, and my part of the health insurance and the union dues. About the same time, Gene and I were feeling so good about our money sense that we made a financial mistake as well. It was still in those early days after the big pay hike, and I'd been reading about the need to save for retirement. If one account is smart, two would be smarter. So I opened a Roth IRA, a retirement account independent of the 401k at work, and plunked down $6,000 as the initial contribution. I fully expected to put in a similar amount every year after that. We were on our way to financial independence, trips to Hawaii in retirement. Dreams are nice. Then you wake up. By the next year, our credit card was groaning with the high balance. I mentioned New York City was expensive, right? We realized that we'd have to make do with the 401k alone. We couldn't afford to put thousands of additional dollars away every year. So we liquidated the account. That's no simple thing, however, since there were penalties for withdrawing the money before retirement and fees to pay. We ended up getting back about $3,500, which a financial expert would call a negative return on investment. It was irksome and embarrassing, but we needed the cash. It turned out to be as expensive a way to pay down the cards as going to a loan shark. Thinking about it today, I realized that we could have put the money away with an automatic payroll deduction, which would have required paying $115 a week to reach that $6,000. But putting that on top of the 10% of my income we were already contributing to the 401k would have pinched us. So we kept our retirement contribution to 10% of my income and focused on the other pressing financial issues before us. After all, we were starting a family. Gene and I had decided to have kids. Actually, the conversation went something like this. When we talked about getting married back in our Austin days, Jean wanted to talk about having kids as well. I asked her to promise that we wouldn't even talk about having children for 2 years. We were already making one enormous decision, and I didn't want to have to deal with any others right away. There would be too much else going on in our lives. I wanted to get a job, have insurance, have a sense that my career was on track. She agreed. Toward the end of 2 years, she said, "You know, it's coming up on 2 years." "Okay," I said. On our second anniversary, she said, "It's been 2 years." I said, "So we can start talking about it." "No," she explained, "we're done talking." See how easy that was? We had already been together from our dating into marriage for 10 years. We'd found ways to accommodate each other. There was some give and take, but also a recognition of when one of us had reached an unbudgeable position. We had friends who would battle any disagreement to the end of time, neither of us felt it was more important to win an argument than to move on. That's how money discussions go with us, too. We might argue over how much to spend on this or that, but we generally agree on what we really need to spend our money on, what is most important. Over time, we have developed a division of labor of sorts. Gene deals with the bills, and I pay what attention I can to our long-term financial goals. It's a good division of labor, especially for me, since the bills require constant fretting while our approach to our investments is not to think about them at all. We have other divisions of labor that work well for us. I'm computer tech support and worry about things like making sure the water level in the boiler is right. That makes me the home handyman. Gene's the one who recognizes when I'm trying to fix something that is beyond my abilities. Then she calls an actual repair person, who inevitably looks at the way I've, say, wired a light switch, shakes his head and exclaims, "It's a good thing you called me. This place could have gone up any second." Then she pays the bill. And that's the way it's been, for richer and for poorer. There would be tight times, but we'd never quite gotten past that cheapo college waif way of doing things. So we've been lucky in love, especially when it comes to our ability to agree on money stuff. Millennials, am I right? Starting out today is way harder. I came into the employment world on the tail of the recession of the early 1980s, and while the economy was recovering, the advertising that supports print publications is often late to respond to shifts. Jobs were tight. But I still got in. Now think about what lies ahead for the next generation, those starting out in the past decade. Compared with them, baby boomers like Gene and me, for all our problems and mistakes, had it easy when it comes to economic opportunity and the ability to build a secure financial future. Many of today's young people emerged from college in the middle of one of the most ruinous economic downturns in U.S. history, and with the kind of college debt that past generations didn't have to deal with, into a world of narrowed possibilities. The thought hit me hard in mid-2016, when I was listening to a talk by Patti Smith, the singer and punk poet, for staffers of the New York Times. Her passionate music was an important part of my 20s, and 30s and 40s and 50s, to be honest, and it was wonderful to hear her speak. But one thing she said left me sad and troubled. She said that kids write to her today, and they want to do what she did. They want to head up to New York with $5 in their pockets, find a cheap apartment, and live the life of an artist and poet. She said that she has to tell them, "You can't do that anymore. New York has changed." If she was starting out today, she couldn't do what she had done back then. She's right. It's now a city for those with money to burn, and New York is not the only city that's become a playground for the richest. San Francisco? Good luck. Heck, even Austin is too expensive for the slacker lifestyle I loved in the 70s. Los Tacos is long gone. Do today's young people starting out have the same opportunities we had? Of course not. Gene and I feel fortunate to have grown up when we did, when we could live on our own in dirt-cheap apartments and buy that avocado with sofa cushion change. When we moved to New York City, we weren't living Patti Smith's bohemian lifestyle, thanks to my having gotten that job at Newsweek. But we had friends who were scraping by with low-paying jobs and living in ratty old apartments in Alphabet City, and played in rock and roll bands. It was harder, but still possible. We didn't have as much economic opportunity as our parents did, but we seemed to have dodged a bullet compared with the millennials. The large population of young people born between about 1980 and 2000, and the Generation X and Y that came after our baby boomer generation. The prospects for the younger generations to outstrip their parents in earning power has diminished greatly over time. According to the economist Raj Chetty and his colleagues, if you were born in 1940, you had a 92% chance of earning more than your parents did. Born in 1960, you're down to 62%. If you were born in 1980, the odds that you are out-earning your folks are just 50-50. These figures are not guesswork. They are drawn from millions of tax records over the decades. You can only wonder how the numbers will look for millennials. David Leonhardt, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his economics columns in the New York Times, called the data deeply alarming and said, "It's a portrait of an economy that disappoints a huge number of people who have heard that they live in a country where life gets better, only to experience something quite different." He rightly tied these grim figures to Americans' distrust of so many institutions, the federal government, corporations, the news media, and others, as well as the roiling election season and the victory of Donald Trump. Leonhardt calls for steps to address the fundamental issue here, which is income inequality. Improved access to a good education, a tax policy that is more fair to the middle class and less servile to the richest Americans, a reduction in corporate power and the strengthening of labor unions, as well as steps to address income inequality. All of it is beyond the scope of this book and my expertise, and is the subject of great books by stupendously smart people. Joseph Stiglitz's The Price of Inequality and Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century and Timothy Noah's The Great Divergence. Leonhardt closes his excellent article with optimism. "If the American dream could survive the Depression and then thrive in a way few people imagined, it can survive our current troubles." I hope he's right. In the meantime, the kids are not all right. 1/5 of young people in their 20s and early 30s live with their parents, writes Adam Davidson in the terrifying 2014 article, "It's Official, the Boomerang Kids Won't Leave." A generation ago, that number was closer to 1 in 10. By 2016, the numbers looked even worse. The real estate website Trulia estimated in 2016 that 40% of young Americans between the ages of 18 and 34 were living with their parents, the highest percentage in 75 years. It's as if the post-war boom never happened. Young people are more likely to be living with the folks than with a romantic partner, according to the Pew Research Center. Of course, it's wrong to assume that a young person living with parents has failed. Many of them are making a sound financial decision about how to save money while starting a career, especially if they are also burdened with student debt. Stiff rents and lagging income growth make the old bedroom a rational option once the soccer trophies have been boxed up and moved to the attic. But the boomerang trend also means that some of the better engines of the economy, including home construction and sales, are weakened. And the sheer size of these numbers is troubling. The media is no help. The media obsesses over millennials because there are so many of them. They are a demographic segment and a market. So the stories abound with their endless questions. What are millennials buying? What are they reading? What are they killing? Who will they vote for? And what is their problem? We seem, as we so often do, to be asking the wrong questions. Before I go further, let me acknowledge that lumping all millennials together is ridiculous. The attempts by journalists and others to corral a broad and diverse population of Americans by age is an exercise in marketing, pop sociology, and the worst of a trend journalism that is likely to produce shallow generalizations rather than insights. My favorite example, Time magazine tried to capture the millennial stereotype with a cover image in 2013 that showed a good-looking redhead in butt-hugging, lime-colored jeans taking a selfie, with language that would become infamous. The me, me, me generation. Millennials are lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents. Why, they'll save us all. That me, me, me was a twist on the phrase made famous in Tom Wolfe's 1976 cover story for New York Magazine, The Me Decade. So the Time cover is journalistic archaeology, too. The last line, "Why They'll Save Us All," is a classic news magazine hedge, but it did nothing to balance the lazy insult added to a generation's economic injuries. These young people never asked to have their prospects harmed by a sludgy economy and college debt even higher than the fancy climbing wall at their university gyms. Little wonder that many of them end up living with their parents, and also resonating with the economic message of fundamental unfairness in the economy that Bernie Sanders was sending. That's why the Time cover was such a mess, despite its ending on an attempt at a positive note. Millennials responded with glorious snark, creating instant parodies of that cover. They held on to the redhead, but changed the words. One took on the entitled Boomers and Gen Xers, who were looking down their noses at these kids. The unemployed generation. We derailed the economy. We destroyed the environment. We allowed and praised corporate greed. We elected crooked politicians. We started wars we won't be fighting in. We are racist. We are sexist. We are homophobic. Yet damn those unemployed social media-obsessed millennials. They are the problem. Gene and I share the anger. We have ourselves made three millennials, basically out of materials lying around the house. Each of them is great, and their differences show the absurdity of lumping people together by age cohort and expecting them to fall into patterns. Our oldest, Elizabeth, crammed her undergraduate work at the University of Michigan into 3 years and got a law degree from the University of Texas with her husband, Matt. They both practice law in Texas, where they own a great house outside Austin and have a delightful baby girl. They sound like baby boomers. But with one enormous exception, they got out of law school with $200,000 in debt between them, which is as much as a house. They will pay it off, and we are helping where we can. But it's hard, and it's a hell of a boulder to be chained to while trying to start your career climb. I wonder how anyone can build retirement savings while simultaneously trying to chip away at that rock. When our middle child, Sam, was 10 years old, he got very serious and asked me, "Dad, is there a job where you don't have to do a lot of work, but make a lot of money?" I told him I was still looking. He's 27 now and recently told me, "I'm still looking for that niche in life where I'm getting rich without having to work too hard." He is our adventurer, has traveled the world, working long enough to get the money for another trip. Along the way, he met an Australian woman, Courtney, who has as much global wanderlust as he does. He likes Elizabeth and Matt's lifestyle, but decided not to go to law school after seeing the debt they had built up on the way to entering a shrinking profession. He'd rather make a living on his terms and without the burdens that his sister faces. He briefly lived with us between jobs and before his marriage, but he was eager to get moving again. At the moment, Sam and Courtney are getting ready to travel to China, where they'll be teaching English. I have no idea where they'll end up next. He's recently talked about law school again, but I have no worries about their independence or resourcefulness. Our youngest, Joseph, is still college age. It's too soon to say how he will turn out, but he's anything but a millennial narcissist stereotype, and I believe he'll find his way. Each of these three homegrown millennials is unique. None of them fits any easy stereotype. Though, selfishly, I wish they'd pick up a newspaper every once in a while. And though, sure, I love to brag on our kids, I see plenty of determined, dedicated millennials all around me. Some of the most hard-charging journalists at the Times are in their 20s. They are smart, terrific, and the opposite of spoiled. That's why it pained me to see the reaction among some younger readers to my Times essay about my retirement worries. Dori Shafrir, a 30-something novelist and writer at the news and entertainment website BuzzFeed, issued a scorching critique on, where else, Twitter. 58-year-old New York Times writer worries about retirement. Learns he's totally fine because pensions. How nice for him and his generation. We've never met, but I love Shafrir's work. She wrote a wonderfully honest and smart piece a while ago about freezing her eggs. She tweets with insight and a scalpel's edge. Her response to the story, she said she found it grating on many levels, including what she saw as underplaying my own privilege, set off a bit of intergenerational conflict on Twitter, where doing battle is as easy as coming up with 280 characters. Some people stood up for me, noting, as my colleague Nicholas Confessore did, that I'd acknowledge that my generation had it better in terms of pensions. She was still unhappy, characterizing my argument as, "I'm healthy enough to work till 70, so I'll keep collecting my high salary while 20-somethings struggle to find work." Okay, I thought, so I'm supposed to die. While I try my best to be obliging, there are limits. As a sign on a colleague's desk reads, "I can't make everyone happy. I'm not pizza." I tried to explain myself. I wrote a follow-up piece for Times Insider, a part of the New York Times website where reporters talk about their work, and pointed out something that had been missing from the Twitter discussion. That, as I said in the piece, I'd been saving since my 20s, though I had not paid much attention to the way the 401k was behaving. And it's true that conventional pensions are going the way of the coelacanth. Still, I concluded in the Insider essay, "There's no doubt that some of the things I've got going for me are getting harder to find. So, you know what? She's right. And that stinks." It doesn't help that even when journalists try to figure millennials out, they can't help taking an accusatory tone. The Atlantic had a good story about the fact that some studies showed that millennials may not be saving money to the same extent that older people are. But its titles seem to wag a finger. "Why aren't millennials saving money?" When that title went out as a tweet, millennials reacted with scornful and self-aware responses. "We're broke as hell," tweeted one. "Buying too many selfie sticks," joked another. The Atlantic piece was, in fact, a well-documented riff on a Moody's Analytics report, cited in the Wall Street Journal, that found that those under 35 have a savings rate of -2%, compared with the positive savings rate of 3% for those between the ages of 35 and 44. The savings rate for the under 35 group in 2009 had been 5.2%, so the rate had dropped substantially. The author of the Atlantic piece, Bure Lam, gave some good reasons for the lack of savings in her age group, including the millennials' staggering college debt and distrust of banks. The piece did not deal with contrary evidence that these young people may, in fact, be saving pretty well. A survey by the Transamerica for Retirement Studies, released earlier that year, suggested that 70% of millennials are, in fact, saving for retirement through employer-sponsored plans or self-funded plans like 401ks. And that they started saving at the age of 22, much earlier than older folks. That study is based on telephone surveys, and people tend to lie to pollsters, but it's still a counterweight for all that hand-wringing. And what if the doom and gloom turns out to be wrong? Catherine Rampell, a columnist at the Washington Post who writes on economic issues, said that the Moody's data was not so dire. Young people almost always have had a negative savings rate, with dissavings for earlier generations of youth far worse than that among today's supposedly irresponsible millennials. There are signs that things might be looking up for this young crowd. The Federal Reserve of New York published a report in January 2016, showing that the average annual income of recent college graduates has jumped to $43,000. The highest in more than a decade. So, who knows? After this long period of pain, and if the economy holds, the kids could turn out all right after all. Let's all root for them, even if they think I'm in the way. Punch list. Starting out in your 20s. Whether or not you have a job with a pension, you can do what we did, but smarter. These three deceptively simple steps will set 20-somethings on the path to financial stability. 1. Save more, spend less. I don't want to sound like a scold, but these are the years to develop strong habits of saving. This will help you avoid debt and interest charges on purchases, and will provide you with a cushion against emergencies. Financial writers offer plenty of tips intended to help you save, but the best way is simply to begin. Set up automatic deposits from each paycheck in a savings account, separate from whatever retirement funds you build. There are many, many books and websites offering tips and tricks about living within your means, but the bottom line is common sense. Avoid extravagance. Think about the things you buy and why you are buying them. Ask yourself if you need them. Don't deprive yourself, but a little mindfulness goes a long way. 2. If you have credit cards, pay them down. If you don't, you'll be spending money to pay off interest, and you could probably rack up late payment fees as well. It's like having a big hole in your pocket. If you have cards with benefits like airline miles and rebates, keeping a zero balance means you get the benefits without giving the credit card company so much money that it makes the benefits no bargain. As the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston put it, paying off credit card debt has a riskless return that averages around 14%, which no other asset class can match. 3. Set up a 401k or an IRA. Saving is a habit that you can build. So start saving for retirement just as soon as you can, especially if you have an employer that matches your 401k plan. Free money. Find out about your payroll plan at work. If you are self-employed, look into the options offered by your state government. A few years of savings early on can add hundreds of thousands of dollars to your retirement fund over the decades. You don't have to start with 10%. You can open your 401k with a smaller percentage of your income and add a percentage point a year until you build up to 10%, or better. When you get a raise, put part of it toward retirement. If you never see the money, you'll never miss it. 4. Pick your funds wisely. There's no need to get fancy starting out. Make simple mutual fund choices, and don't invest in more complex financial instruments like annuities or exchange-traded funds until you've given yourself time to study up. But which investments? How are you supposed to make sense of them? That is what the next chapter is about, whether you are in your 20s, in your 30s, or older. Chapter 3. Your Investing Primer. A man who loves money is a bastard, someone to be hated. A man who can't take care of it is a fool. You don't hate him, but you got to pity him. Stephen King, The Stand. Gene and I had come out of our retirement review feeling pretty encouraged. But let's face it, our good fortune basically came down to that one smart decision in 1986 to siphon off 10% of my income into a 401k built on a set of hastily chosen mutual funds. From there was the happy circumstance of staying employed and working at companies that had decent pension plans. In setting my financial course, I had no strategy, no deep understanding of what I was trying to accomplish. I might as well have been throwing darts at a list of mutual funds. Starting early meant it has worked out well enough, but if I'd known more at the start, I could have done better. So, in this time of reassessment, I wanted to make sure I fully understood what the guy from Vanguard was advising me to do about my 401k. I needed to learn more, to find out whether we could do better with the time we have left to build that retirement nest egg. Could we be more comfortable, more able to travel? And when we shuffle off this mortal coil, to leave something to the kids? I dove into research mode, trawling the websites of government agencies, financial organizations, and the incredibly rich and contradictory world of personal finance journalism. I did this not just so that I could